You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of Funny Business by Anthony Bresnahan. The first thing director Jason Reitman wants people to know about Saturday Night is that it may be about funny people, writers and performers who unquestionably redefined comedy, but it's not intended to be a laugh riot. The movie plays out in real time over the course of about 90 minutes, and there are certainly uproarious moments, but even more tense and fraught ones. The story starts at 30 Rockefeller Center at 10 p.m. on October 11, 1975, and culminates with the first ever broadcast of Saturday Night Live. What unfolds is a ticking clock suspense movie. It's a thriller comedy, if you can call that a genre, Reitman says, of the film, which arrives in theaters on October 11th. I always describe this movie as a shuttle launch, and the question was, would they break orbit? Nearly 50 years later, we know that the show will go on, of course, but watching the desperate scramble is unnerving nonetheless. Chaos reigns, egos clash, drugs flow, passions erupt, and pressure builds until everyone involved seems ready to feed one another's fingertips to the Wolverines. Google that classic SNL joke if you don't know it. At the center of this maelstrom is the young producer Lorne Michaels, played by Gabriel LaBelle. The actor, who was 21 when he filmed it, was 9 years younger than Michaels was when SNL started, which adds to the sense that the character is in over his head. We meet Lorne as he's still forming. He is a genius, and he has a vision beyond anyone else there, and anyone his age. It's a lot for an actor to carry, Reitman says. In this movie, everyone gets to kind of screw around except for Gabe, who has to be the metronome. This movie's version of Michaels is not the dapper, seemingly unflappable TV maestro viewers have come to know. Reitman consulted with Michaels during pre-production, but dissuaded LaBelle from trying to talk to him beforehand. LaBelle latched on to other details instead. He credits a piece of arcane Bill Murray lore for reconciling his own unraveling version of Michaels with the smooth operator he later became. Everyone sees him as this fearless leader, this captain who's steering the ship in the fog, LaBelle says. Bill Murray, when he came back to host the show 15 or 20 years after he left, said to Lorne, "Wow, you really figured out how to do this." Murray is not depicted in the film, since he joined SNL in its second season after Chevy Chase departed and started making movies. For LaBelle, that remark underscored the fact that it took time for the SNL producer to settle into his steadiness. He started it when he was 30. He's now 80 and has been doing it for 50 years. Nobody knows what to do when they first start. Saturday Night tells not just Michaels' story, but virtually everyone's from that opening night cast and crew. This is about not only the first seven actors, but the writers, the art department, and everybody who came together at the last second to change television, Reitman says. What was so unusual about this show was not only that it was live, but the format was unlike anything anyone had ever seen before. You had sketch comedy, you had two musical guests, you had a live band, you had stand-up comedians, you had Andy Kaufman, you had the Muppets, you had a film by Albert Brooks. Many of the movie's central characters were unknowns who became household names. Matt Wood plays the human hurricane that was John Belushi. Dylan O'Brien is a pertinacious, look that word up while you're at it, Dan Aykroyd. Ella Hunt is the fairy-like, Gilda Radner, and Corey Michael Smith achieves armor-piercing levels of sarcasm as Chase. Meanwhile, Emily Fairn's Lorraine Newman layers costumes atop each other so she can hop within seconds into the next sketch. And Kim Matchula's Jane Curtin and Lamorne Morris's Garrett Morris bond over their shared uncertainty about what the show could be and whether they belong. Each of the not-ready-for-primetime players has a different arc in Saturday Night Live, but they end up at the same destination together. The whole movie is the story of people trying to figure out what their identity is on the show, Reitman says. The story we tell is the moment each of these comedians find the way they coalesce as a group, which I think is the reason the show eventually was the success that it is. The movie also delves into the behind-the-scenes wrangling of the NBC team that brought SNL into America's living rooms, including Willem Dafoe as imperious NBC executive David Tibet, who must decide whether the show is fit to air live. And Nicholas Podney plays aspiring comic Billy Crystal, who's heartsick at being cut from the first show just before it aired. The way it's always told is that he took the train back home and got there just in time to tell his family not to watch, Reitman says. This is a movie where the villain is time. It's like our Sauron. Our Darth Vader is a clock, and you feel its presence at all times. And Billy loses to the clock. Next photos, Radner takes a ride on the lap of a camera operator to get a bird's-eye view of Studio 8H before broadcast. Andy Kaufman, Nicholas Braun, rehearses his Mighty Mouse number. Michaels huddles with Chase and his girlfriend, Kaya Gerber. Having known and interviewed Reitman for almost 20 years, I've noticed that one constant in his life and career is a fascination with the mechanics of comedy. He's the son of the late Ivan Reitman, who produced Animal House, directed Stripes and Ghostbusters, and helped bring the wild vibes of Saturday Night Live's stars to movie screens. Jason grew up around Aykroyd, Murray, Crystal, and Chase. He's best known for his feature films, among them Juno, Up in the Air, and Young Adult. But that fascination with dissecting humor also inspired him to direct the 2016 short Roast Battle about the brutal camaraderie of insult comics. Reitman's first production company was even called Hard C, based on the linguistic comedy theory that K sounds make the best punchlines. I don't know if you can print this, but my example was always punched in the dick is nowhere near as funny as kicked in the cock. Saturday Night Live originated in the same lifelong curiosity. Anyone who is a self-described comedy nerd, you're interested in the weird chemistry of what makes something funny, he says. Next photo, Morris showcases his pipes by singing a number with musical guest Billy Preston's band. An endless number of books and articles have been written about SNL, but Saturday Night is not based on any of them. Writer Reitman and co-writer Gil Keenan researched their script by picking the brains of more than 30 original sources. We interviewed everyone we could find that was alive from opening night, Reitman says. Every living cast member, every living writer, people from the art department, costumes, hair, and makeup, NBC pages, members of Billy Preston's band, I mean anyone we could find. Newman recalls sharing her memories with Reitman and Keenan in a video chat during the pandemic. She thinks the prospect of the movie is thrilling, even if she feels uneasy about the idea of watching herself on screen. It's an honor in a lot of ways, and I hope it's well received, she says. I still can't believe that anybody would be interested in us old codgers at this point, when there's been so many great casts since then. But I understand the genesis of this thing that's lasted for 50 years could be interesting. Newman's anecdote about guest host George Carlin, who's played by Matthew Rhys, Objecting to a sketch about Alexander the Great's high school reunion became a key part of the film, and she's grateful that Reitman focused on the strange mix of stakes they faced that night. "We were led to believe that nobody was watching. 11:30 p.m. was considered just a dead time," she says. "There was no expectation that the show would last. So really, it was like we were doing the show for ourselves. That's what it felt like." She answered questions, not just from Reitman, but also from the actor playing her, as did some of her former castmates. Garrett Morris bonded with Lamorne Morris, who'd actually been claiming to know Garrett since he was a kid. "Obviously, we had the same last name, so I used to tell people that he was my dad as a joke," says the actor, who's best known for Fargo and New Girl. Now that they're friends, the 87-year-old Garrett is running with the gag. "He called me and said something about owing my mom a call because he's not convinced that he's not my dad," Lamorne says. "He feels there's a genuine connection creatively. Subconsciously, you are picking up cues from those before you. No matter what I do, at some point, it probably came from Flip Wilson, Garrett Morris, Richard Pryor, Eddie Murphy." In the movie, Morris feels adrift and uncertain about this new endeavor. Obviously, race plays a little bit of a factor in it, especially during those times when folks didn't necessarily know if this was Lorne just trying to fill a quota, Lamorne says. Also, Garrett was about a decade older than his co-stars, so there was a distance there as well. Lamorne notes that his predecessor was a Broadway singer and a playwright, among other talents. His journey is, "Hey man, I got all these skills. I've been a part of the civil rights movement. I've helped desegregate the acting unions. All of these things have happened to me, and here I am with all these kids telling dick and fart jokes. It's like, what am I doing here?" Ultimately, the character comes to see the strange show as ideal for his offbeat versatility. As Lamorne puts it, he finally goes, "Hold on, there are a lot of things I can do, and I think this is the place where I can do all of them." He adds that Garrett made a simple request of him. He said, "Tell the story as it happened. Be honest about it. I just want the audience to know that I did not quit. I never gave up." Next photos, Michaels and SNL writer Rosie Schuster, Rachel Sennett, attempt to coax Belushi into finally signing his contract. Milton Berle, played by J.K. Simmons, rehearses a corny showgirl bit for another NBC special, leading to a clash with the brash SNL cast. Not all of the SNL tales that the screenwriters gathered took place in the countdown to Showtime on October 11th, but Reitman and Keenan took some artistic license to merge the most compelling stories into one night. That included hints of now-beloved sketches yet to come. Michael's giving the Weekend Update job to Chase instead of performing it himself, and a demoralizing encounter some of the cast had with Milton Berle, played by Reitman stalwart J.K. Simmons, when the hopelessly old-school yuckster hosted the show a few years later. Some of their research took place just in time. "Three people that we interviewed have now passed away," Reitman says, including writer Ann Bates, costume designer Fran Lee, and production designer Eugene Lee, who also gave the filmmakers original schematics that allowed them to recreate Studio 8H in its entirety inside a soundstage in Georgia. Those designs turned out to be so accurate that when LaBelle finally did get to meet Michaels in person, he felt an uncanny sense of déjà vu. It was in March when Josh Brolin hosted the show, and the movie production had shifted from Georgia to New York to shoot outside of 30 Rock. "We were invited to watch an SNL live," LaBelle says. "Someone was like, we'll take you to Lorne's office because people hang out there to watch the show. I remember following this person on our way there, but knowing how to get there already. It was a weirdly familiar environment. You're like, I've been here." Seeing the real Michaels in person was a bit unreal, but it didn't spook him. "I didn't need to ask him anything. I didn't need to try to hack him," says LaBelle. whose breakthrough role came playing a variation on a young Steven Spielberg in the director's own movie, The Fabelmans. I think it was more weird for Lorne than it was for me. I was used to that kind of weirdness of, I'm here to be you. A House Divided by James Reginato. The Mellon dynasty has long been known for its old money refinement and discretion. But when Tim Mellon became Donald Trump's biggest donor, many members of the family were mystified and not afraid to talk about it. Opening photo, Land of the Free. The main residence, dubbed the Brick House, on Paul and Rachel Bunny Mellon's former Virginia estate, Oak Spring. and next photo, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, Timothy Mellon in 1981 as he was expanding his railroad empire. Think of the Brady Bunch, a member of the Mellon dynasty recently told me as he tried to explain some family dynamics. Though 70s kitsch could hardly be further from the great banking and industrial fortune, the relative was referring to Paul Mellon and his blended family. But instead of Alice the housekeeper, more than 100 staff members were on duty at Oak Spring, a 4,500-acre estate where the walls were adorned with masterpieces by Van Gogh, Degas, and Manet. House guests included the likes of John and Jackie Kennedy, Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip, and Charles and Diana. Paul's wife, Mary, had died in 1946, leaving him with their 9-year-old daughter, Catherine, and 4-year-old son, Timothy. 2 years later, when he married Rachel Lambert Lloyd, she moved into Oak Spring with her 2 children, Eliza and Stacy III, from her marriage to Stacy Barcroft Lloyd, Jr. Bunny, as Rachel was called, became known as a paragon of refinement, understatement, and discretion. Nothing should be noticed, she famously declared. It was an old money credo that her stepson Tim, now 82, seemed to live by. Little ever appeared in the press about him, except for a wedding announcement in 1963 and occasional articles revolving around his interest in trains and planes. Unlike other elites with access to the levers of power, he barely engaged in politics, making only roughly $350,000 in political donations between 1996 and 2017, according to the Wall Street Journal. Then, in 2018, he sent $10 million to the Congressional Leadership Fund, the super PAC, that runs ads on behalf of House GOP candidates. In the 2020 cycle, his contributions to conservative candidates and causes totaled $70 million, including $20 million to Donald Trump. And since the start of 2022, he has poured in more than $125 million to Make America Great Again, the Trump-affiliated super PAC, and $25 million to American Values 2024, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. super PAC. Tim Mellon is the most consequential mega donor of this contentious election and the least known. When Tim first reached out to MAGA World to offer his largesse, they had to research him. Reportedly, he has little interest in meeting candidates or attending events, and he communicates with some by fax. Some information came to light in 2020 when the Washington Post first reported on an e-book Tim had self-published in 2015. With the oddly punctuated and cased title Panam.Captain, it was an autobiography as well as something of a manifesto. In it, he wrote that black people became even more belligerent and unwilling to pitch in to improve their own situations after the expansion of social programs in the 1960s, and that Americans who relied on the government teat were slaves of a new master, Uncle Sam. After inquiries by the Post, the e-book was withdrawn. On July 23rd, a book with the same title was released by Skyhorse, whose founder, Tony Lyons, is also a co-founder of American Values 2024, the super PAC backing Kennedy. Lyons is also Kennedy's publisher. Apart from some reminiscences of his school days, Tim writes little about his family or his personal life. His efforts to build a railroad company and learning to fly take up most of the 171 pages. Aside from a photo of Tim as a small boy with his maternal grandparents, there are no pictures of the author. In an appendix, he reveals the itinerary of a trip in which he flew around the world, his medical history, 2008 prostate removed, and his 20 favorite movies. Number one is Casablanca, My Cousin Vinny is sixth. Via his publisher, Skyhorse, Tim Mellon declined to be interviewed for this story. but a number of Mellon family members and confidants agreed to speak. I'm just as surprised as you are about my uncle coming out. I couldn't believe he was mentioned in the press. He's the most private Mellon there is. He's been very quiet up till now. His nephew, John W. Warner IV, told me during a phone call from his home in Virginia. One of the three children Tim's sister Kathy had with Senator John Warner, to whom she was married from 1957 to 1973, Warner IV is a military historian and former race car driver. My generation, and the younger generation, is unhappy about his very public support of what we think of as anti-democratic causes and candidates, says a cousin of Warner IV. Again and again, I've heard dismay about him going in this direction. One of the cousins said it just makes her sick. Next photo, Silver Circle. Lady Bird Johnson, with Paul and Bunny Mellon at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. A highly private individual, according to some who know him, Tim Mellon divides his time between his vast properties in Wyoming and Connecticut. He's had three wives and four weddings, but no children. He's socially awkward and wears old aviator glasses with tape on the bridge. He is apparently fond of Patsy Cline, has a fascination with Amelia Earhart, and an obsession with a medieval Norwegian church. His early philanthropic giving suggests that he once had some liberal impulses. Unlike many other old money clans, the Mellons are still loaded. 175 years later, the Mellons have never been richer, read a headline in Forbes, which estimates that the family is currently worth more than $14 billion. They've got staying power. Of America's billionaire dynasties, only the DuPonts have had a longer run. The family fortune originated with Paul's grandfather, Tim's great-grandfather, Thomas Mellon, who arrived in western Pennsylvania from Ireland at age 5 in 1818. After studying law in Pittsburgh, he invested in real estate and opened a bank. With his wife, Sarah Jane Negley, the judge, as he became known, produced 6 sons and 2 daughters. Thus, the Mellon family tree has many branches. But Thomas and Sarah's 6th born, Andrew William, Paul's father, was the real empire builder. A.W., as he was known, built a colossal fortune from banking to oil to aluminum before he became Secretary of the Treasury under Presidents Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover. In a recent Substack essay, Robert Reich, who served as Labor Secretary in the Clinton administration, asserted that policies pushed through by A.W. in the 1920s, cutting the estate tax by half, whittling down the top income tax rate from 73% to 25%, allowed him to shift much of his fortune to his heirs tax-free, setting the stage for immense wealth and more specifically enabling his grandson, Tim, to bankroll the Trump campaign today. Timothy Mellon is the product of a tax system pioneered by his grandfather that allows the perpetuation of dynastic wealth and the maintenance of its political power, wrote Reich. Yet Timothy Mellon rages against only handouts that go to those born without silver spoons. Echoing A.W.'s discernible politics, to his family he was domineering, cold, and distant. Paul and his sister Ailsa did not have a happy childhood. After their parents' rancorous divorce in 1912, they were shuttled from one cheerless Pittsburgh mansion to another. With his first marriage to Mary Conover Brown, who graduated from Vassar and studied at the Sorbonne in Columbia, Paul was finally able to pursue his interest in art and psychology and break away from Pennsylvania. After traveling to Switzerland to undergo analysis with Carl Jung, the couple settled at Oak Spring, an idyllic estate in the Hunt Country of Virginia. Where they began to bring up Kathy and Tim. Ailsa, who had only one child, a daughter named Audrey, with David K. E. Bruce, also became a resident of Virginia as well as New York. But tragedy struck in 1946 when Mary, 41, died of an asthma attack. The trauma of Mary's death overshadowed my life for some time, Paul wrote in his 1992 memoir, Reflections in a Silver Spoon. I remained in a state of shock. Tim and Catherine adored their mother. He never got over losing her, a cousin told me. Next photo, Parisian persuasion. Former First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy visits Paris with Bunny in the late 1960s. Uniting his family with Bunny's at Oak Spring proved difficult. Neither Paul nor Bunny were skilled parents, and the four children had very different personalities. Dinners were strained. A number of sources recall a precious 18th-century porcelain cabbage that sat in the middle of the table. Tim, they said, would often reach over it to grab something, leading an irritated Bunny to snap at him for fear he would break the cabbage. As a little boy, he was very gregarious. In time, he became brilliantly mathematically minded, Bunny observed, adding, he has confidence but not curiosity to branch out, according to Burton Hirsch in The Mellon Family, 1978. In the same book, she noted that Tim's political and social mindset, so different from Paul's, started emerging during adolescence to the alarm of his father. If Tim had a radical idea, Paul pounced on it. Oh, you'll learn better. You'd better change, Bunny recalled to the historian. The problem was Tim was already rich, being the beneficiary of $100 million trust instruments and other bequests from his grandfather, according to Hirsch's book. It's hard with children who are on the same economic level. They simply don't have to listen, Bunny lamented. Tim made his feelings about his stepmother plain when he declined to discuss her with Hirsch. I hope you don't want to open that can of worms, he said. According to I'll Build a Stairway to Paradise, Mac Griswold's recent biography of Bunny, Paul agreed with Bunny that Tim was a very difficult child. Boarding school offered one solution. At age 10, Tim was enrolled at Finn, near Boston, then continued his education at Milton Academy in Yale. Before his freshman year of college, he proposed to his girlfriend, Susan Tracy. Though Sue had good credentials, being a Bryn Mawr girl and the daughter of the president of Esso Standard Oil, Bunny tried to nix the wedding. According to Hirsch's book, Sue wasn't very deferential to Bunny. At the end of Tim's junior year, the couple won out and got married. After graduation, they moved into a simple house in Guilford, Connecticut. In the early 1970s, she helped him determine where his foundation, the Sachem Fund, should make donations. Recipients included the ACLU and a feminist law firm. They also helped finance an inquiry into poor housing conditions on Navajo reservations and a campaign to rebuild a hospital in North Vietnam. For 3 years, Tim worked at the Yale Computer Center before he opened a business that developed systems programs for small computers for educational institutions. He's a quaint introvert with a very smart analytical mind, according to one of his relatives. In the early 1980s, a company he founded, Guilford Transportation Industries, began buying up rail lines from Maine to Maryland, building a 3,900-mile railroad empire that would dominate New England freight traffic. In the years to come, Tim maintained limited contact with family. In the penultimate paragraph of Hirsch's book, a quote from Tim is portentous and rather chilling. My view of families is that they're an anachronism. The family unit is not a functioning entity anymore. It no longer serves an economic need. I suppose it's interesting as a social phenomenon. Tim is not the first far-right money bag in the family. In the 1990s, Richard Mellon Skyfe became the principal funder of the vast right-wing conspiracy against Bill Clinton. Skyfe was a grandson of A.W.'s younger brother, Dick. The lion's share of Mellon's still lives in Pennsylvania. Many of them are Republicans, according to Warner IV, as was Paul during his lifetime. He died in 1999, even as Bunny, a fervent Democrat, became intimate with the Kennedys. You want to know where the Mellon Enclave is? It's in Ligonier, says Warren IV, referring to the lush, rolling hills about an hour southeast of Pittsburgh. The Ligonier crowd, as he calls them, is a mixture of conservative and liberal and everything in between. One of those is Christopher Mellon, who is descended from the judge's second son, James. Christopher served as a deputy assistant secretary of defense for intelligence in the Clinton and George W. Bush administrations. Recently, he made headlines when he joined a small group of former officials with security clearances who came forward to reveal secret government studies of UFOs and to sound the alarm about the security threat they pose. He and I share the UFO extraterrestrial involvement issue, Warner IV says about his third cousin. He's on the ultra-conservative side, and I take the moderate side. You know, we're not alone. Big deal. The big deal is that the military-industrial corporate intelligence complex has been hiding the possibilities of what's going on out there. Most members of the AW branch are based in the Virginia, D.C. area, and almost all of them are Democrats. They also seem to think of themselves as the true royalty of the Klan, as one member phrased it to me. This branch includes Ailsa's grandchildren, the children of her only child, Audrey, and Audrey's husband, Stephen Currier, himself related by marriage to the immensely wealthy Warburg family. In 1967, the couple, both civil rights activists, disappeared in a mysterious private plane crash. The wreckage was never found. Orphaning, Andrea, 10, Lavinia, 9, and Michael, 5. With their inheritances from Ailsa, who died in 1969, Mrs. Ailsa Mellon Bruce dead, called richest woman in the U.S., read the headline of her obituary in the New York Times. And the Warburgs, the Currier children, became possibly the wealthiest of the Mellon scions. Harvard-educated Lavinia, an environmentalist and filmmaker, is very involved with Tibet issues and has a close relationship with the Dalai Lama. When I interviewed her about one of her films in the late 1990s, she expressed horror over the activities of Richard Mellon Scaife. For a liberal Democrat like myself, I'm embarrassed to be a Mellon right now with this fellow running around. The Pennsylvanians and the Virginians rarely meet. Matthew Mellon, a younger brother of Christopher, was until recently the highest profile Mellon. Given his flashy lifestyle with his first wife, Jimmy Chu co-founder Tamara Yerdai, his cryptocurrency advocacy, and his battles with drug use. Nobody recognized him when he appeared at the funeral service for Eliza, Tim's stepsister, in 2008. He just showed up. He wasn't invited, a Virginia Mellon recounts. He comes up to me, "Hey, it's so great to be here for the family." I'm like, "Who are you?" Matthew died in Cancun in 2018. In the early 1980s, following his divorce from Sue, Tim married Louise Whitney, an Upperville, Virginia native who had been a childhood friend. After she and Tim divorced in the early 1990s, Tim married Patricia Trenery Freeman, who was recently divorced from Charles Chaz Freeman, Jr. A classmate of Tim's at Milton and Yale, as well as best man at his first wedding. Chaz, a diplomat, gave an interview around 1995 in which he said, "I had a quite happy marriage of 30 years with her, which broke up in the summer of 1992 in a very nasty way." Tim and Patricia, who had three children with Chaz, later divorced and then remarried. In an email to me, Ambassador Freeman commented, "Tim Mellon's callous betrayal of our friendship was almost as hurtful as my then wife's abandonment of me for reasons she declined to explain." In 1998, Tim purchased brand rights to Pan Am Airways after it filed for bankruptcy. He rebranded his rail company Pan Am Railways. In June 2022, CSX announced it had completed the acquisition of Pan Am Railways. Terms were not disclosed. while the London Times has reported that Tim has a net worth of $1 billion, Warner the Fourth says, I read that he's worth $4.2 billion. He further says the combined worth of the Mellon clan today is more like $25 billion. These families don't want the public to know what they're worth. Given his uncle's wealth, his political donations are not huge outlays. It's pocket change for him, says Warner the Fourth. He must have spent a bundle on a most unusual project on his estate in Lyme, Connecticut, a bucolic area where colonial-era saltbox houses are the norm. Tim's property encompasses hundreds of acres, but passers-by on a small road have been astonished to see an exact replica of a Norwegian stave church dating to the 12th or 13th century. Toward the end of the Viking period, when Norway became a Christian country, numerous stave churches were built. The wooden structures feature a series of roofs, each one offset and becoming smaller as the church reaches toward the sky. Marvels of engineering, they require an intricate system of beams and pillars. Tim decided he wanted a full-scale replica of the stave church in Borgen, Norway, which is considered the finest of the genre, erected on his property. After many reconnaissance trips to Norway, a team of skilled workmen spent years painstakingly recreating it in lime. It was an obsession of his. It's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen, I was told by one of the apparently very few people who has seen it up close. He doesn't want anyone to see it. I know people who have gone down that road to look at it, and he's chased them out of there, a local told me. In the majestic but sparsely populated south of Wyoming, where Tim bought a vast ranch in 2005, he suffers no interlopers. I can think of no place on earth more quiet and peaceful and conducive to easy concentration, he writes in Panam.Captain. In his golden years, Tim has the wherewithal to finance passion projects. In 2012, he donated stock valued at more than $1 million to the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, to help finance their search for the remains of Amelia Earhart's plane. After the expedition failed to find the wreckage, Tim located video footage that he said revealed the debris. Claiming that the organization did not act on this evidence, he sued it for fraud and other claims. The suit, which dragged on for 2 years, was eventually dismissed. A happier outcome seems to be on the horizon in Winchester, Virginia, where in 2016, Tim donated property to develop a park adjacent to the home of Patsy Cline, now a museum. The project is slated for completion this year. Relatives and Mellon family friends I spoke to are puzzled as well as disturbed by how far to the right Tim has lurched. He's always been a contrarian. That's the only thing I can think of that might have gotten him in this direction, which does not reflect our values, says a cousin. He's always just been one of those guys who's gone to the beat of his own drum and operated very quietly, says a member of the younger generation. Paul, this person said, would be aghast at the Trumpification of the Republican Party and his son's support for it. He'd be appalled. I think Paul would be vocally upset at Tim. I remember him being a lovely, nice man, a friend of Bunny's says about Tim. I just don't know how he got involved with such kooky extremism, because he wasn't brought up in that kind of environment. I don't know who he listens to, but he should be smarter. Even for him, this is outrageous. Bunny would be very appalled. He was into Rush Limbaugh, says Warner the Fourth. My mother told me she was furious about that. She told him, you idiot. Why are you listening to that idiot? Tim's like, I like it. I'm the only libertarian, and Tim is the only Republican, Warner the Fourth continues. Tim and Kathy aren't particularly close, he says. They talk maybe twice a year, but they're friendly. She was a hippie type. She still is at 87. They're polar opposites. Warner the Fourth's comments speak to a time when people on different sides of the aisle engaged. before the right went so far to the right. It killed my dad at the end of his life. He was just so sad about what happened to the Senate. He had a lot of Democratic friends. He was a middle-of-the-road moderate Republican. Parts of me are conflicted because he's been very nice to me, but I'd love to sort of dig through his mind to figure out how he is supporting these people and disrupting the system, says a younger member of the family. I honestly think a lot of it has to do with how Trump brought down the barriers of decency. It got to the point where these people are like, if we don't support him, there's nobody else we can support at this stage. We can't support a Democrat. In his mind, and with others like him, they have lived very much independently of the government system. They don't really need to have a relationship with most Americans. The way I see it, Tim is just not a very social person. He's not integrated himself with a lot of community. I guarantee you, he's not one of those people who likes Trump's character. He probably thinks he's an asshole. I think what it comes down to is he wants to be left alone, and he wants no one to tax him. It's that libertarian viewpoint that's become radicalized. There are a lot of really rich people out there who just don't need to think about what's best for America anymore. It's just setting aside the interest of a lot of people for yourself. Why is he doing this? Bunny's friend exclaims. People say, oh, you know, taxes. Well, what does he care? He doesn't have any children. He can never spend all the money he has. It's just crazy. Tim is a stepfather to Pat Freeman's three children. In the end, Tim remains inscrutable to many. He doesn't communicate with us. Last time I saw him was at Bunny's funeral, says Warner IV. Bunny did leave a bequest to her stepson. Just one thing, the porcelain cabbage. It was her way of saying, here's your porcelain cabbage, says a relative. Now don't break it. Given Tim's political donations, the younger Mellons I spoke to fear not just for American democracy, but for their family legacy. As one of them put it, we generally come to our politics and philanthropy with a sense of compassion for other people. The MAGA folks and the causes that Tim is supporting are completely lacking in compassion. That's not the way we want to be remembered. Now this from Daisy Shaw Ellis, Treasure Chest. An exhibition puts the jewelry of iconic hip-hop artists on display. Try conquering my crown, and that's really, really very silly, Slick Rick rapped with characteristic insouciance in his song The Ruler's Back, 1988, a narrative that later nods to the smashin' fashion of Friends at a Party. At the American Museum of Natural History's Ice Cold exhibition, that very crown is on display and is pictured above, along with pieces from the jewelry collections of Notorious B.I.G., Tyler the Creator, and Nicki Minaj. The show, held in the Mignon Halls of Gems and Minerals, tracks the phenomenon of jewelry and hip-hop music as wearable trophies that signify success, affiliation, and reverence. All the artists were taking their cues from street culture, says guest curator Vicky Toback, and that ostentatious street is runway sort of thing. Prized items include Nas's famed QB piece, a rose gold and diamond Rockefeller Records pendant by Jacob & Company, and two of Erykah Badu's grills by Lillian Shalom, a glittering symphony. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.